Today we begin with Acts chapter 19, verses 11 and 12, building on that study from last week about demons and demonology. And Acts 19:11 says, God wrought or did special miracles by the hands of Paul, insomuch that unto the sick were carried away from his body handkerchiefs or aprons, and the evil spirits went out. In our time, people have all kinds of strange ideas about miracles. They will sometimes define a miracle in terms of something that should have happened or could have happened or would have happened and didn't, and the thing that could have happened or should have happened or would have happened would have been very bad, dangerous, perhaps deadly. It didn't happen, and they said that was a miracle. I'm going to give you a little preview of what we have, we think, on deck for our April potluck that's coming up. We had a man here and his wife probably about 3 months ago. He's maintained some contact with me, and it turns out that about 11 years ago, he became famous. He was someone who had a small amount of flight training, and he, Easter weekend, I believe that was 11 years ago, was on a King Air flight, not qualified to fly that kind of plane, had never flown that kind of plane. He happened to sit in the cockpit on this plane and wanted to monitor some radio traffic. 10 minutes into the flight, the pilot dies. So you can imagine, he's the only one on board who knows how to fly that particular plane. And with him gone, it's movie time. So this brother was able to successfully land the plane, and it was such a big deal in aviation history that they're going to make a movie about it. MGM Studios has picked up the story, and that movie's supposed to be out later this year. So he's going to be speaking, and we think that that's going to be at our April potluck, the second service, and hopefully have a little video for us, and that should be exciting. But when that happened, if you go back and you look at some of the reports, and there's a ton of stuff about him on the internet and that plane, I think he still probably gets some information from people as far as asking about what happened or congratulatory letters, those kinds of things. There are references to the miracle of Easter weekend. Because here's this guy, has no idea how to fly this plane. I mean, he's got some general basic flight experience, but as far as this aircraft, I need some help. And they they broke FAA rules. They had to get somebody on a cell phone, which was a no-no, 1,000 miles away, who knew how to fly this plane to get into land. And they say, well, that was a miracle. I think he'd be the first to tell you God's providence, he believes, was surely involved, but that was not a miracle. When we talk about a miracle, we're talking about the suspension of natural law. That's what we see here in Acts chapter 19, verses 11 and 12. When you start looking at Bible miracles, some of them obviously were temporary. When Jesus is out there with his disciples on a boat stilling the storm, that is a temporary miracle. Do you think that there were additional storms later as the years passed? Sure. I mean, that was just how that worked. But for that occasion, the bad weather was stopped. You have, for example, Jesus multiplying food. Well, after the food was made, the bread was replicated, the fish, did that happen every day of the week? No, so that was limited to that particular time. It was a one-time event as far as it happened on this occasion, and then on another occasion or so, but it was not something that happened daily. But then you have some other things that had ongoing benefits. When someone had their sight restored, that would have continued. When someone had, you think about Malchus, the ear that was restored, someone like Lazarus coming back from the dead, those had lasting consequences. Bible miracles were definitive. They were things that people could see, things that people could verify. But more importantly, when you start studying Bible miracles, and this is a point that I think a lot of people miss, the miracles in the Bible, they are not just haphazard. When I hear people today talk about miracles, that's kind of, well, you know, God is the God of miracles. If you go back and you start looking at miracles, you begin to find that miracles occur in very specific periods when it comes to Bible history. There's a reason for that. What's the first period of Bible miracles that you see? Well, first.
The first miracle?
Yeah, the first period of miracles. Where do you see them show up?
Creation.
Well, yeah, you could go back to creation. Obviously, God's kind of revealing himself, setting things up. So we understand that, okay, that six-day period created miracles there big time. Then you move forward a little bit in biblical history, and where do you see miracles again?
Blood.
Well, okay, that's kind of a one-time event, but that definitely was a miracle. But I'm talking about a series of miracles. Oh, come on, it's not hard.
Egyptian.
There we go. Moses, right? Getting God's people out of Egyptian bondage, you've got another batch of miracles there. So creation, then you move over to Moses, and what's God doing? He's revealing himself, right? I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and I'm going to take you out, and I'm going to reveal my law, all those kinds of things. Then as you move forward a little bit, you come to the period of Elijah and Elisha. More miracles there. Another, again, a huge batch. Why? Because these fellows are going to introduce that period of the prophets. And what's God going to do through the prophets? He's, again, going to reveal himself. This is my word, and this is my will. And these are some things that you need to avoid doing. These are some things that you need to stop. All right, then we get to that 400 silent year period between Malachi, John the Baptist, the opening of the New Testament. God has stopped revealing himself. He's given that information. People have the Old Testament. John the Baptist shows up. John doesn't do any miracles, but Jesus comes up, and what's he start doing? Well, there's a bunch of miracles. But what else is Jesus doing? He says, I've come to reveal some information about God, and I've come to reveal a New Testament system. So there is this pattern, and the apostles as well. Well, after we get to the apostles, the end, what happens? They had revealed all the truth, Jude 3. The faith was given once for all time, and guess what? Since you've got this full revelation now, God says, no more miracles. The purpose for them has ceased, and people today are looking for them, hoping for them, sometimes claiming that they're performing, they're being performed, or they're performing them, but that simply is not the case. Okay, now if you've got God doing these things, and in Acts 19 and verse 12, it talks about special miracles, such as we have there described in the 12th verse, it would be logical if Satan is the counterfeit for the devil to do what? All right, let's do our miracles. It's kind of, it's not exactly parallel, but when you think about someone in the world, they come up with a great product. And I mean, this is really nice. This really works. Well, it may not be China, but somebody else is looking at that product and thinking what?
I'm going to copy it,
and I'm going to make a knockoff. Now, if you've ever shopped at a discount store like Aldi's or maybe some of the other markets out here that some of the Amish use, you begin to find some off-label products. And sometimes you might like that off-label product better. But generally, I think you will find a lot of people who have become accustomed to a certain brand. Maybe that was all that existed for a little while. And then you are exposed to the knockoff. Anybody ever had a bad knockoff?
Yes.
All right. There, I guess we don't have to go down the list, but someone might say, no more generic ice cream, no more generic cheese, or no more generic tools. Because the first time I tried it, you know, I got sick, or the first time I tried it, the handle broke, whatever it might be. Well, the devil has been involved with this kind of stuff really throughout the book of Acts. Do you remember back in Acts chapter 8, verses 9 through 11, who's the fellow who's the sorcerer who became a Christian? Simon the sorcerer. He was involved with that kind of stuff, right? Now, maybe he didn't know that it was a devil. Then you got back in Acts chapter 13, verses 6 through 10, there is this guy by the name of Elimaeus, Bar-Jesus. He's described as a false prophet and a sorcerer. We have in the next verse, we haven't gotten there yet, but Acts chapter 19 and verse 13, we're going to read about some Jewish exorcists. And then if you back up a little bit in Bible history, thinking about Jesus in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 24, when the Lord was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, he said that people were going to show up and they were going to produce signs and wonders. And not only said they produce signs and wonders, he says that these were going to be great signs. The false signs would be impressive. We have talked about this maybe in a Bible class way back when, but anybody ever watched the Carbonaro effect? Oh, really? It's a relatively clean program. This guy is a very good magician. I mean, he is really, really good if you've not seen him. I'll just kind of give a couple of illustrations. There was one time where he claimed that he was able to get a lot of orange juice through a special device. And this is one of my favorites. So there are a couple ladies who come up and they're standing there and he says, oh yeah, you seen our little juicer? No, we love juice. Okay. So he takes this orange and then he just, you know, does some squeezing and he fills up like an 8-ounce cup of juice. And the lady is there, and he's talking about, oh, yeah. She says, well, I'm a big grapefruit girl, and I think it was a grapefruit. Maybe it was an orange. And he's got a pitcher, like a lemonade pitcher. And from one orange or one grapefruit, I'm thinking it's an orange, the pitcher just fills up. And her eyes just, all that from one juice? Oh, yeah, you just really worked that pulp. Then there's another one where there's this guy. He is with his wife by the poolside. And they're kind of relaxed, and they look like they are people who have, you know, just kind of achieved the time in life where they're financially comfortable and just all kind of stretched out. And he shows up as a waiter. He said, "Would you like a drink?" Well, you know, we got one. I said, "Oh, we make great drinks." So he says, "Well, here's how, you've got our little tablets here. They look like Rolaids. Let's put some in a glass." And then he just reaches over and it looks like he scoops up pool water. And after he scoops that up, he's got what looks like a yummy peach drink. And this guy drinks it. Hey, boy, that's really good. And the guy says, "Oh, yeah, you know, we came up with these tablets in our garage. Let's see. Now, this is the expensive version. They're 2 cents a piece. It may not have gone exactly like this, but this is pretty close. I'm probably a little off on the math. Let's see. 2, 4, 6, 8. 8 cents, and then we probably have to throw in a couple pennies for the water. Probably no more than 10 cents. We can tell that this guy is, he's thinking, "Wow, have you franchised this?" So he is really, really good as far as his tricks. So when I think about these false miracles in the Bible, people like magicians have been doing some incredible stuff. When you can take an orange and you can make it appear like it fills up a pitcher, you know, about a 4-quart pitcher, or it looks like you can scoop up pool water, people have been doing all kinds of things. There was another one where he was down at a beach, and it looked like he turned a woman into a mermaid. He has really freaked some people out with some stuff. So when you start talking about a magician, some people are really, really good at that. And some people have done this kind of thing with the devil. All right, Paul, he's able to do these special miracles. I gave you a reason for that last week. Anybody remember why? What was true for Ephesus? If you came there, what would you find? You'd find magic. You'd find people who were involved with the occult. So this kind of stuff that I mentioned from this magician, I mean, people have been doing these kinds of tricks for a long, long time, and the people at Ephesus were really interested in that kind of stuff. So Paul's in this environment. God understands that, so he allows Paul to work special miracles. It would be like going head-to-head with the best of the best in some respects. And these people, when they saw what Paul was doing, they were impressed. We haven't gotten there yet, but Paul, the Bible says the people who were exposed to him and his preaching, the imperfect is used to say they kept coming, they kept confessing, and they kept declaring. Remember from Mark chapter 16 and verse 20, Jesus talked about the signs, the apostles, and the people who had gifts would perform. He says that is to do what? To confirm the word. And that's exactly what was taking place. Came across a story, used this in the Revelation study not too long ago. It was about a woman who was living in a refugee camp, and she was really into the spells and the incantations and stuff because she feared evil spirits. And one day, a Bible-believing woman comes to this lady's house. She sees all the stuff, all the spells that this woman has written on her wall to be a good luck charm and keep the evil spirits away. And this woman says these words, "I have words more powerful than these." I thought, I love that. And can you imagine something like Paul? I have power that's greater than this. If you're impressed by these tricks, let me show you something. Now, when you look at that text, it says that initially, if you didn't have that context, you would look perhaps and think, well, hey, what kind of special miracles could Paul do? When you start looking at the Bible, what kind of miracles do you read about? I mean, incredible miracles.
You want an example?
Yes.
Raising people from the dead.
All right. Back in Acts chapter 9, Peter does that, right? Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm going to think about a special miracle, that's going to be pretty special. What else? Special miracles.
Getting rid of blindness.
All right. I mean, this guy has never seen for almost 40 years. Walking on the water. I mean, opposing a demon. All those things seem pretty special to me. And yet, the Bible says, as you look at Acts chapter 19, that Paul is doing these special miracles. What would have made his miracles distinct or unique? Well, let's see if we can get the impression from verse 12. He talks about in verse 11, you know, he's there, and then we have these special miracles. But what do you have in verse 12? What's it say?
People were taking his handkerchiefs.
Yes. A lot of times when we read about healing in the Bible, and this would be true in Acts chapter 9 when you think about Peter healing Dorcas or Tabitha. Is he off 20 miles away? Where is he? He's right there with her. Now, that's one thing. I mean, it's incredible to either say to someone that you're right by, you're healed, or to touch someone and say you can now see and that happens. But what happens if you're not in the same room? What happens if you're not within eyesight of somebody? That kind of takes the healing to a different level, doesn't it? And if I'm going to trick you, you know, chances are I got to be right there. There's really no way to trick somebody to say, okay, you know, I'm going to perform my magic and you're 20 miles away and you're healed. It just will not work for the fakers. So here was the line of demarcation. Here was the thing that really separated Paul. The people were able to take away claws from his body, things like handkerchiefs or an apron that had touched Paul's skin, and then that's placed on a sick person and that individual is healed. Has the modern religious world tried to replicate that? Remember I talked to you about counterfeit signs earlier? What do you see with some of the faith healers, the wealth and prosperity preachers? Caller 800 number, and what am I going to send you? I'm going to send you my prayer cloth, right? Well, if that really worked, you think that would make the news? I mean, it would. People would say, you know, he didn't come. Would you have to have a healing crusade like these guys do? Advertise for weeks and weeks and run out the big coliseum in town so everybody can come? No. Just say, here's a cloth, you know, send it out. So this was how God decided to show that Paul was distinct from the other fakers at Ephesus. And there are some really, really good fakers. You find the King James that adds the word diseases because of a manuscript variation, but the problems that Paul was able to heal through the power that God gave him included evil spirits. And notice this, they went out from people. And verse 15 tells us, we'll get there in a little bit, that they knew who Paul was. So I'm impressed by the magicians, but today when people come along and they say, well, I've got a sign, I've got a power, always bear in mind that some of it, with a magician, they're not trying to deceive you with satanic power, but the devil has been very, very good as far as counterfeit signs. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down to verses 13 and 14? Brian, we'll start with you.
I thought there were one of Paul's companions that was sick at the top of us.
Yeah.
Right. But, so Paul didn't have perpetual healing that could have taken care of things like that, or didn't use it anyway.
Yeah.
So there was something special that God wanted to happen.
Yeah, you obviously had Christians who died because they're no longer here, but you also read about sickness. Timothy, for example, was another one. Paul talked about a little wine for his stomach's sake. He was someone who had some medical issues, so why not heal him? You do have back in, what is it, Matthew chapter 8 or 9, maybe it's Matthew 9 about verse 14, that Peter's mother-in-law was sick and Jesus healed her, but there was a case where apparently she needed to serve, they needed some things and she was healed, but it's rare. Almost to the point of non-existence to find the idea that Christians were sick or God's people were sick and they were healed just because of the sickness. That confirmation of the word is what you see time and time again. So that's an excellent point. All right, Teresa was going to make that point. Anybody else?
Isn't that what was being done here is confirming the word in
Yes.
Because of so much of the
yeah.
stuff or the magic.
It was. I like to think about Moses. I'm still impressed by the magicians in Egypt. I do not know if some of their power was satanic or not. If it wasn't, they were really good. When you think about the lice, and you think about the flies, and you think about the blood in the Nile, I mean, those were major, major signs. But that's why I spent so much time on the Carbono effect, because if you go back and you see this guy, it is possible to engage, whether it's of the devil or not, it's possible to engage in some really, really good trickery. And, you know, people will be deceived by that sometimes.
That's kind of the same with Moses. You know, when it first started, the magicians at that time could duplicate some of the first plagues that Moses did, but then it got on down and it's like, oh, we can't do that.
Yeah.
We can't do that. So it kind of built to say, okay, yeah, here, we can do the same thing, and you're doing the same thing, but now look, we're past what you're
doing. It's a crescendo effect.
Our God is past.
And you see that same kind of thing, I think, in Acts chapter 19. Paul comes, and then perhaps as word begins to get out, you can almost see people saying, well, we can do the same kind of stuff. Okay, really? This handkerchief was taken from my body and it just cured somebody of leprosy or cured somebody of blindness or cured the fellow who's never walked. let's see you replicate that. And that puts him in their place. And then if that's not enough, then you've got this involvement with the demon that we're preparing to read about. Before we look at that, anybody else want to say anything? Okay, let's move down to there to verses 13 and 14. But certain also, notice the word also, story continues, of the strolling Jews, exorcists, took upon them the name over them that had the evil spirits, the name of the Lord Jesus, saying, I adjure you by Jesus whom Paul preacheth, 14. And there were seven sons of one Sceva, a Jew, a chief priest, who did this. Now, if you're Paul, and you've got all these people out there interested in miracles and signs and performances, and you're going out there and you're preaching and you are teaching, you're performing some signs, and you start doing these special signs, you think that you're going to attract some people. I mean, you're going to thrust yourself pretty much into the midst of all this. And it's sort of put up or shut up. You remember the old gunfighters way back when? You got the guy who's a fast draw, and you got this fellow over there, and somebody sees how fast he is, and he's thinking, well, hey, you know, he might be quicker than him. Let's go ahead and see a matchup. Well, that's kind of what it seems like was happening here. We've got these exorcists, these strolling exorcists. They were Jews, and they were at least somewhat familiar with Jesus, and that Paul was preaching the Christ. It seems like, as you go back and you start looking at this stuff, even in some places today, there is the idea, and there has been the idea, that if you know the name of a God, if you know the name of a power, you grab onto that name, you latch that name, and if you, it's almost kind of like the old cartoons about the genie running the lamp. Rub the lamp, you know the name of the genie, you give the right command, the genie shows up, and then you command the genie. There have been people who have had that kind of thinking with evil spirits. That's what I'm getting from the text as far as how these people thought that this would work. If they knew the name of Jesus, the one that Paul was talking about, and they simply adjured the Lord to cast out evil spirits, then Jesus would need to do their bidding. Well, based on what we know about Jesus, how well do you think that's going to go? You just decide to latch onto the name of Jesus and say, Jesus Christ, I urge you or demand that you cast out these evil spirits, and you're not one of his people. Probably not very well. The Lord's probably going to let you get whacked. And that was true on this occasion. Verse 14 says that there was this chief priest, Sceva. Some of the Jewish high priests were legitimate. Some were not. We do not know what was true for this man. We also want to make a note about the man's sons. Now, generally, when someone says, I have a son, how's it understood? Well, I didn't ask my question very well. How do we understand the connection when somebody says, this is my son? All right, you're the father. This is my biological child. In the Bible, though, you do have son being described in some slightly different ways. For example, back in 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse 3, Luke 11 and verse 19, you have there the idea of son being used in the sense of disciple. Now, for us, that's probably not the most common thing that we hear, but biblically. So it could be that these sons were the literal descendants of Sceva, but biblically it's also possible that they were the disciples of Sceva. And that definitely could kind of put us in a different realm. Maybe Sceva had gotten involved with this kind of thing, and he picked up some disciples, and here are seven of those guys. We do not know which way to understand the text. Both are possible. I will give you this note. Josephus, he's an interesting historian for a lot of reasons. Some of the stuff that he wrote is definitely, we would say, wrong. Some of the stuff seems to be somewhat reliable, and some of it seems to be, we would say, absolutely reliable. But I'll tell you this. In one of his Antiquities, 8:2-5 would be the reference. He claimed that Solomon learned how to expel demons and supposedly left behind him the manner of using exorcisms by which they drive away demons so that they never return, and this method of cure is of great force unto this day. I'm not sure how much stock to put in that, but I would say at least that historical information tells us that there were some Jews who did have an interest in casting out demons. I don't think that there was some kind of spell that Solomon came up with. I don't think his wisdom gave him that, but at least they were thinking about these kinds of things. And when demons did show up, there were people who were very, very interested in that. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at 15 and 16? Okay, let's move deeper into the story. And the evil spirit answered and said unto them, Jesus I know and Paul I know, but who are ye? And the man in whom the evil spirit was leaped on them and mastered both of them and prevailed against them so that they fled out of that house naked and wounded. Now these two verses are packed. I mean literally filled with information about demons, and we'll try to sort through that little by little. First of all, as I look at these two verses, I find that demons were able to speak. Now, it's not stated whether the speaking the demons were using the man's voice or perhaps the demons were, the demon was using its own voice, but they were able to communicate. If demons are fallen angels, it would make sense to me that they at least had the ability to speak, because don't we find when it comes to good angels, they have the ability to speak? I mean, you read through the book of Revelation, John talks about what this angel said, and you look back in Isaiah chapter 6, for example, you got the seraphim, holy, holy, holy. You've got the angels showing up when, you know, Jesus has come out from the tomb. Angels there, and, you know, he's not here, he's risen. So they certainly are able to communicate, and if that's true for good angels, inference, I think, would say the implication would be that we are able to infer, because the Bible implies that evil angels also had the ability to communicate. Would you say that these demons were able to process information? Did they have knowledge? Again, we're just dealing with one here. All right, he says, I know who?
Jesus.
All right, I know about Jesus, and I also know about Paul. And that knowledge is not surprising, but knowing about Paul raises some questions, at least some questions in my mind. Did this demon know about Paul in the sense that Paul had been working as a Christian prior to the time of Ephesus? I don't know. He certainly seemed to be at least somewhat familiar with Paul's work at Ephesus. So when he became tuned in, I don't know. You also, I think, if you were looking at this, could have some other questions in mind. Did he know the names of the other apostles? Or was Paul the only apostle he knew about? I find that to be a very interesting question. I'm not sure that we can come up with any kind of answer. And then as you take that question and you probe it a little more fully, did he know the names of any Christians? Did he know the names of every Christian? Now, there's a passage in the book of Revelation which I find to be somewhat helpful, and it's Revelation chapter 9 and verse 4. When we're trying to understand how much demons know, that passage doesn't answer every question, but I do think it gives us enough insight to draw a conclusion or two. Somebody want to flip over there and read that for us from Revelation 9, the fourth verse? All right, Gary's got it.
And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads.
Okay, do you think John was talking about being a good environmentalist in Revelation 9, 4? Think the green is literal or not? Don't hurt any green thing. Don't hurt the grass. Don't hurt the trees. Think that's literal or not? It's not. When you think about green, well, what kind of color you want for your yard?
Green.
Ray, you lived in California. When they had brown out there, was that the favorable color, or would they have welcomed some green? Yeah, but green would have been nice.
Green would have been nice.
Green would have been nice. All right, the green is a metonymy. It is a way of describing the righteous, God's people. You want to read it once more, Gary?
And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, neither any tree.
All right, don't hurt God's people. That's the message of Revelation 9:4. Well, now, if you are the demon, and you're getting this command, don't hurt God's people. What's got to be true?
You've got to be able to recognize them.
You've got to be able to identify them. Now, how do you identify them? Well, do you know all their names? That's a possibility. When you look at the book of Revelation, you obviously have some people marked. You know, John talks about the mark of the beast, the unsaved, but also God's people, the saved, are also righteous. So how does the devil and his associates identify Christians? I don't know. Is there something that happens to us when we become a Christian that we can't see, but the devil can? I don't know. It could work that way, but there, I got your hand, Gary. There is some way for the devil to identify God's people. Now, how that relates exactly to Acts chapter 19, I don't know. But God's people can be identified. Revelation chapter 9, Paul was identifiable to the point where the demon actually knew something about him and his work. Maybe that extent of the knowledge doesn't apply to every single Christian. So those are the two passages that I'm aware of that kind of help in that area. Gary?
So he says in the first half of that verse, don't hurt God's people through the color green, living things. But then the end it says, but only those which have not the seal of God in their forehead. So I'm assuming that's figurative too.
The non-Christians, yes.
Yeah, that we don't walk around with seals on our forehead.
Yeah.
So there had to be some distinguishing characteristic.
There is, and that seems to be in the spiritual realm somehow. And what that is, I don't know. Very, very interesting. Anybody else on that? Tim?
I was just thinking that maybe the mark that we can't see, that the spirits can see, God can see, is that the things that Christians do, the way they conduct their lives, can be, if it's not the whole seal thing, I'm thinking it's part of it.
Yeah, I that's the area where I lean as far as the Bible talks about God's people being sealed. This is going to be a poor illustration, but at least it points us in the right direction. You look at a barcode, what do you see? Yeah, it looks like just a bunch of, you know, chicken scratches. But if a scanner looks at the barcode, what's it see?
Information.
Huh?
Information.
Well, yeah, and sure, what kind of information?
Information.
All right, there's the price. There is the item. Maybe there is the size.
There's the brand.
You have all kinds of information there. We can't see it. I mean, we can see this, the barcode, or we can see the human body. But just as the barcode has some things that are not visible to us, but the scanner can see it, that may be true in the spiritual realm as well. Brian, did you move your hand or? Okay. Okay, let's move down a little bit more and see what we've got as far as the latter part of verse 15. The demon asks who the seven sons of Sceva are. Now, if we had no additional information, that question could be understood in one of two ways. It could be understood as ignorance. They could have been saying, look, we have no idea who you are. We don't know if you're a Christian or a non-Christian. Or, and I favor this idea because of something else we find in the text, it could be saying you're talking to somebody and you say, who are you? Or who do you think you are? Now, if we say that to someone, might we know who they are? Absolutely. I mean, you know, maybe it's our wife. Maybe it's our husband. Maybe it's our child. So we absolutely know who they are, but why do we say that? Who are you? Who do you think you are? Why do we say that? All right, we disagree with what they're doing, or we are questioning their authority. Who do you think you are in the sense of what gives you the right to do that? And I lean towards the idea that that's exactly what the demon was doing here. They understood that Paul was a Christian. They understood that Paul had the power to come against any kind of demonic force, but that was not true for these people. There are two different words in the original text for no. The first one is applied to Jesus. And this demon says, I know Jesus. And this is the kind of knowledge which we would use to say, I have been with you and we've done things together, or I've touched you, or we've interacted with one another. And this demon is making that point. Well, wouldn't that be easy to understand? Why was this demon able to say, I know Jesus? If the demon started out where?
Heaven,
righteous angels, they were there, you know, back in creation time, and they spent some time up there, so he knew Jesus. But then he comes along and he uses this second word for know, and that word is associated with Paul, and it means to, I know about him. I understand him. I've got some comprehension of him, not to the same degree as with Jesus. So it seems like he was saying, I do know that Paul has the power to come against me, but you characters, you have no authority. Well, Luke demonstrates that lack of authority by saying the demon, King James translation. Anybody have it? What did the demon do? He? Luke 19.
He leaped on him.
All right. He leaped on them. I find that to be interesting. And if you have the ASV, maybe some of the translations, it's different. When you think about the King James rendering, it says it or he leaped on them. How many would that be?
Them would be plural.
All right, it would be plural, and we would expect that to be all seven, right? Because the seven sons of Sceva. But if you have the ASV or some others, it doesn't use the plural like that. Anybody have the word both? All right, some of the versions, and this is because of a manuscript variation, will say, leaped on both of them, only two out of the seven. I bring that up not to confuse you, but to let you know that there is a manuscript distinction here, and I don't know that I can say definitively that it was all seven. I do kind of favor that, but there are some manuscripts which do say both. regardless of how many sons were attacked, the assault, would you say it was successful?
Yes.
King James says prevailed against them. The ASV says mastered both of them. And what happens? They
ran out of the house.
They flee. They run out of the house. Now, you don't see too many people running out of the house. But when a fire happens, or there's perhaps an explosion somewhere, or maybe there is somebody trying to break in the back, people will actually run out of the house. Well, this demon was so vicious that it caused them to do that. They fled out of the house, and they were, the other two descriptions,
naked,
and they were wounded. One source said naked means forcibly stripped. Now let that sink in for just a little bit. Somebody forcibly strips the clothing off of you. What would come to mind if you're dealing with someone who gives you that description? I was forcibly stripped of my clothing.
Vicious.
All right. I mean, it sounds like maybe they're trying to hold you down a little bit, and I mean just rip and pull and tear. Not nice. Anything else? All right, you would think as far as the strength level, probably one person or maybe a couple people to hold you and the other person is ripping. And if this involves seven of the guys versus two, and even if it's only two, but can you imagine the power that was involved? The power to be able to forcibly strip seven people of their clothing? And then not only that, it's bad enough to leave you without any clothing. What else? Wounds them. And again, if it's seven people, can you imagine the force needed to wound seven people? Now, somebody says, well, how bad were the wounds? I don't know. But I would say the wounds were bad enough that Luke specifically pays attention to it, and he's obviously a doctor. Therese?
Well, I think that two would be plenty.
Yeah.
Look at criminals who used to attack in the Old West. Like, two of them got shot. What they do, they retreated.
Yeah.
I think this is the mentality of human nature.
It is. Yeah, yeah. And apparently the demon was at some point let him go or managed to break free of him. But yes, it was very, very bad. When you look at demons, they had great power. We've seen that from Mark chapter 5, verses 3 and 4 in last week's class as far as the guy living out there in the tombs. A couple of the quick notes here that we need to get in today. If these Jewish exorcists had been successful in casting out this demon, what kind of impact do you think that would have made on Paul's work? It would have been damaging. Well, look, this is what he claims to do or can do, but we've got these other guys over here, maybe seven of them, and they're doing the same kind of thing. So it was important for God to distinguish Paul's miracles from either what other people were trying. And in this particular case, this attempt was a complete failure, but not only that, it definitely showed that there was a great distinction. Paul could handle the demons, so to speak, with God's power without difficulty, but these fellas definitely could not. This is not the only time in the book of Acts that we find Paul having to deal with a demon. You may remember a few chapters back, Acts chapter 16, Paul's at Philippi, and there is that girl, that young lady who has the demon. People were making money off of her. Paul casts out the devil, and that got him into quite a bit of trouble. Now, this is, in the book of Acts, and really in the Bible, this is the last time that you read about people casting out demons. Had quite a bit with Jesus' ministry, and you've got what we have up here through this particular point in Acts. And I think that may be a subtle indication as far as what we're talking about before. This stuff, as far as the miraculous, is beginning to wind down little by little. As more and more of God's word is revealed, that miraculous era is starting to close out. Paul said the perfect would come, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 10, the perfect being God's word. It was going to replace the partial, 1 Corinthians 13, 9, and that partial included those spiritual gifts, tongue speaking, prophecy, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 8, and other gifts. I'm going to make one other quick point and then see if there's something that you want to make. When you look at this demon, it knew Paul's name. We're going to touch on this from a slightly different perspective in the morning lesson, but thoughtful people, I think, would want to ask the question, does the devil and do the demons know my name? And not know my name because I want to get chummy with them, but know my name because I'm trying to serve God, live the Christian life. And if the devil doesn't know my name, or if the devil doesn't want to know my name because I'm not trying to really seek God, then that should be a problem for us. So as we live the Christian life, think about from time to time, does the devil know my name? One fellow preached a source on the man who was known in hell, and that's probably not a bad place to be known if we want to be a Christian. Anything that you want to add or ask as far as the final thought? Don?
Well, I think that